It's a new year, and we've got some new laws on the books, but no budget.
A cloudy outlook as we kick off 2017, the state of Illinois again without a full budget.
That's Eric Feldman of WICS. The station's political reporter, Jordan Abadea, joins us to talk about why we're back again without a budget. What does it mean for higher education and for social service agencies who rely on state funding to operate? Plus, one new Illinois law that took effect this week will grant important labor protections to house cleaners, nannies, and caregivers. We'll hear from two agencies that work to pass the Illinois Domestic Worker Bill of Rights and learn what a difference it will make for domestic workers across the state. We also explore, why do agricultural workers continue to be excluded from many federal and state labor laws, including this new one? We'll be joined by a lawyer whose agency offers free legal services to farm workers throughout Illinois. That's all coming up this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. Happy New Year. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed their holidays. This January 3rd, we're starting the year without a state budget. The stopgap funding has expired. We're going to be talking about that later in the hour. But first, the new year has also brought us some new laws. Illinois is now one of seven states that offer domestic workers like nannies, caregivers for the elderly, or housekeepers the right to Illinois' minimum wage, protection from sexual harassment, and one day of rest a week. The bill is known as the Illinois Domestic Worker Bill of Rights. It was actually signed into law last August, but the changes just became effective this January 1st. What difference will this new law make for the more than 35,000 domestic workers in Illinois who cook, clean, and take care of others? To learn more, we're joined up by now by Rosa Navarro with the Latino Union of Chicago. They're an advocacy group that works to enable low-wage immigrant and U.S.-born workers to have dignified, respectful work and lives. We're also joined by Diane Grissett. She works primarily as a caregiver in the Chicagoland area and was among people who traveled to Springfield to lobby for this bill. Rosa, Diane, welcome to the 21st. Happy New Year. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you, and Happy New Year's to you, too.
Diane, thanks for joining us. I know you're out and about today, and you took time from your busy day to speak with us. I just mentioned that you work as a caregiver in the Chicagoland area. What do you do specifically?
I take care of elderly, take care of children, and I also clean homes.
How will the law change your job, the new law?
It changed my job so I can be able to get a day off, one day out of a week. Also, it helps stop discrimination. It also protects us from sexual harassment.
Wow, so it sounds like lots of changes. Rosa, let me ask you, I know that we think about those things that Diane just mentioned. She talked about time off, protection from sexual harassment. People might be surprised to know that up until this new law being passed, that maybe some of these protections were not available for domestic workers in the state. Can you tell us what this new state law will provide for people who are working in domestic work throughout Illinois?
Yeah, and I think as you mentioned, domestic workers have been excluded from most labor rights laws. And so the Illinois Domestic Bill of Rights actually helped ensure that a lot of the basic labor rights that, you know, I have or you would have are also extended to domestic workers who work in private homes. And so that often means being able to get overtime pay for working overtime. Like Diane said, it actually protects them from discrimination and sexual harassment in the workplace. And it also guarantees them a day off. And those are more specifically for direct caregivers and live-in domestic workers that live in private homes. But again, these are protections that weren't necessarily extended to domestic workers historically for a really long time.
Diane, why was it important for you to go to Springfield to lobby for this law? Why did you want to tell lawmakers about this changes that you wanted them to make?
It was important to me because everyone needs someone to help. Like I also said, families or friends might turn their back on you. So people need someone, and it was my opportunity to to go out and help someone because, like I said, I once was homeless and I had no one. So my heart goes out, and that's what I like doing. I like helping other people, putting a smile on their face.
So, I mean, obviously for you, this job is your way of, it's your livelihood. Diane, I wanted to ask, you mentioned about protection from sexual harassment on the job. Is that something you've ever experienced, or you have friends who've experienced that, of people who are in caregiving or people doing domestic work?
I have some of my coworkers who have experienced it. I never did.
Mm-hmm. And Rosa, I mean, when we think about that, we think about challenges that domestic workers may be facing. What kind of protections will now be available for domestic workers when we're thinking about, for example, say, sexual harassment?
Well, they're now actually protected legally under the law, which is a huge thing here in Illinois. And so I think that when we think about the protections, we also need to think about the enforcement. So in theory, the law that went into effect on the 1st of this month will protect them against any forms of discrimination, not just sexual harassment. And I think sexual harassment is something that is super common for domestic workers. It's something that, you know, with a lot of the members that we have here at Latino Union, it's a reoccurring theme of dealing with sexual harassment in the workplace, which is people's private homes. So it's also like now being able to have legal mechanisms to actually fight back against what sexual harassment is, and to kind of empower workers to know that they are protected legally regardless of their immigration status or regardless of any other factors.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you about immigration status, Rosa? Because I imagine this law provides protection regardless of what your immigration status is or what your legal authorization
correct.
For work is. That's correct?
Correct.
And is that something when we think about, and I'm thinking particularly your work with the Latino Union of Chicago to help both immigrant and U.S.-born workers, how does this sort of help people who maybe particularly people who don't have legal authorization to work here. I imagine there's sort of a whole other level of fear of speaking out in terms of retaliation or losing jobs. How does the law address that?
I think a law just kind of helps empower the workers to know that there is legal protection, that regardless of their immigration status, regardless of any other conditions of their living conditions, or that they're actually guaranteed rights under the law. I don't think it's an explicit law that like gives them any other.
You think it's just that act itself, that it's just the fact that the law exists. You know, Diane, can I ask you, do you feel like this law does help? Do you feel more empowered by this law? Do you think that this will be something that will make a difference?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do believe this will make a difference for us because, like I say, we do have something to, like, fall back on now. I mean, you think back then we didn't have nothing to fall back on when it is. So now I believe that it's much better for not just for me as well as my other peers or all homemakers and so all over the world.
Diane, thanks for taking the time to join with us. That's Diane Grissett. She's a caregiver who works primarily with the elderly and disabled. She also does child care, and she's been a member and with the Latino Union of Chicago. Diane, thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
Rosa, let me ask you about when we're thinking about these laws, and I'm thinking particularly about the data we know about the demographics of people who are domestic workers. There's a study that was published in 2013 by the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute that found that domestic workers are disproportionately Black, Hispanic, or immigrant. More than 90% are women. Nearly 1 in 4 live below the poverty line. We just heard Diane say that before she had this job, she was homeless. Do we know why? I wonder if you can help us understand a little bit more about why domestic workers have been excluded from labor law protections in the past, if you can help us understand a little of the history of it.
Yeah, of course. So domestic workers, as well as farm workers, actually have historically been excluded from most labor laws, and that actually goes back to the 1935 National Labor Relations Act that explicitly had language written in the act that excluded domestic workers and farm workers, and that was actually a concession during the time of actually passing the legislation with Southern Democrats in Congress at the time. And a lot of it was to ensure that at the time in 1935, the South was, right, historically 1930s South, it was the Jim Crow South. The laws were definitely geared to discriminate against Black people in the South. And so it was really during that time that these laws were actually explicitly created to exclude them. In particular, that had to do with domestic workers and farm workers in the South were predominantly Black at the time. And so that was kind of politically a way to keep Black workers from organizing and actually demanding fair wages from a lot of sharecropping and a lot of the farms in the South.
You mentioned agricultural workers. We're going to be talking about that in a few minutes, so thanks for bringing that up. Rosa, I know that this bill was sponsored by Senator Ira Silverstein in the Senate, in the House, Elizabeth Hernandez. What kind of did you find that was this a tough law you thought to get passed? Or I wonder, some people who are listening might be surprised that it took till 2017 to have these kind of protections for domestic workers.
Yeah, and it's actually only one of seven states mm-hmm. in the country that actually has a domestic worker bill of rights, right? There's only seven states out of the whole country. And it really was a five-year battle. The first year that it was introduced, the bill was killed and it did not pass. Latino Union, along with a lot of allies and key organizations that also organize labor and domestic workers, actually kind of had to regroup and build a stronger coalition and diversify its coalition in order to really fight for this law to be passed. And like I said, it was a five-year fight that Diane was also part of those 5 years. And so it really wasn't until August of this year that the governor actually signed it. And so, you know, for Illinois to be one of the seven states, it's huge, but it's still not enough. I still believe that we still have to fight for more.
What else? What else do you think is important? What else would you guys like to see?
I think it's just really extending a lot of the other laws, and particularly of having higher wages, of protecting them. And I think the enforcement mechanism in particularly, I think for us, the Bill of Rights was a huge victory, and the passing of it is something that we're still celebrating. And on January 12th, we're actually having a press conference here in Chicago with the whole coalition to really kind of address the Bill of Rights and just kind of like make it public that it's now actually gone into effect and here are the laws that actually protect domestic workers, but also launching an enforcement campaign with it. One of the hardest things has been, and it's just something that we have seen kind of around all the other states that have passed similar laws protecting domestic workers, is that enforcement tends to be the hardest. So I think we're really looking at the Department of Labor right now and really trying to think and strategize on how to create a campaign, a public campaign that would put pressure on the Department of Labor and the state to ensure that, you know, not only is this bill like enacted, but it's actually enforced.
And so it would be enforced through the State Department of Labor because this is a state law, correct? And I wonder,
correct.
You're talking about enforcement. The other half of that, of course, is having workers who are aware of their new rights under the law. How are you trying to get, I know you mentioned that news conference, how are you trying to get the word out to the 35,000 or so domestic workers across the state so they're aware of what their new rights are?
Yeah, and I think as a coalition and also as Latino Union, we are definitely planning large community forums to invite the public. We're also going to be targeting faith institutions. We are going to be doing public service announcements putting out ad kind of announcements in the newspapers. We're kind of trying to just, you know,
spread the
target
word.
A little bit of everything. And our best way to actually outreach to domestic workers is with our actual domestic worker base. So also having our own members trained and versed on the bill and being able to pass on that information and bring in other domestic workers as well.
Rosa, you know, we've got less than a minute left. I just had one last quick question for you. What about employers who are paying workers under the table? I know that domestic workers oftentimes are paid that way. How is that affected? How does that affect this whole situation, like the new law?
You know, that's something that I'm not really, feel like I can really talk to. I mean, I would just say that domestic workers are actually protected under all minimum wage laws. And so I would say that it would affect domestic workers in the sense that they are entitled to minimum wage. They are entitled to overtime. They are entitled to time off. And so I think these are things that apply to all domestic workers, regardless of the way that they are being paid.
That's a summation of the new Illinois Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. Just took effect on Sunday. As Rosa is telling us, Illinois is now one of just seven states in the nation that offer these protections to domestic workers, whether those are nannies, caregivers for the elderly, people who are cleaning houses. I want to thank Rosa Navarro. She's a domestic worker organizer for the Latino Union of Chicago. She mentioned agricultural workers being exempt. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation and look at agricultural worker rights in Illinois and also be joined by the Heartland Alliance. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Rosa, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the Illinois Domestic Worker Bill of Rights. It amends four different labor laws in Illinois to extend different labor protection to domestic workers, whether that's overtime, a right to day off, protection from sexual harassment. Illinois is actually just the seventh state in the country to take such action. We just finished speaking with two people from the Latino Union of Chicago, including a caregiver who shared what difference this new law is going to make for her and the 35,000 other people in Illinois, whether they're working as caregivers, housekeepers, other people in domestic work across Illinois. I want to go now to Darcy Jenkins, who works with the Heartland Alliance. They're an organization based in Chicago that works to end poverty and provide opportunity for all people. They were also involved in working to pass the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. Darcy, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you, too. You know what, Darcy, I understand a big reason that this bill was successful in passing. We were just hearing from Rosa about the years-long effort it took to pass this Domestic Worker Bill of Rights was because your organization made a case to lawmakers that offering these labor protections to domestic workers would also be a way to protect people who are victims of human trafficking. And I wonder if that's what you feel like also finally resonated with lawmakers, that people who perhaps might be being trafficked in Illinois also need labor protection.
Absolutely. So human trafficking has always been an issue that has bipartisan support. It's pretty easy to understand and be against modern day slavery, which is human trafficking. And so anytime that we can help to contextualize this issue or any issue that intersects with human trafficking and modern day slavery, we're more successful in educating our audiences and engaging them in a positive way to impact that change. And this was an opportunity not only to increase protections for workers, but from a prevention standpoint. We all care about survivors of trafficking. We all care about the people working in the homes, taking care of our homes, our children, our families. And so it's a great way to prevent any further or additional exploitation, abuse, and trafficking.
Well, and I think when people think of human trafficking, Darcy, I think many of us think about prostitution or sex trafficking. What's the connection between domestic work and human trafficking?
Yeah, absolutely. So here at Heartland Alliance, we provide direct services to survivors as well as oversee a national program. And though we often hear sex trafficking when we talk about trafficking, we actually see far more labor trafficking survivors than sex trafficking. And of course, domestic workers would fall under labor trafficking. And the connection is due to, as you heard earlier, the exclusion from labor laws, a history of racism. You heard earlier the large number of immigrants, people of color, and women, so marginalized populations who are domestic workers. They're isolated. They're entering an industry, so to speak, that's underregulated or not even regulated at all. And so these are the conditions that allow exploitation and abuse and human trafficking to flourish, to exist.
Okay. So I think how important would you say this worker bill of rights is then to sort of helping bring this group of people maybe under labor protection, maybe as we were talking about, how important is sort of that empowering aspect to helping maybe resolve or end human trafficking?
I think it's really important. I think it's so important and critical to shine a light on this population. They have been working tremendously hard in the shadows, and so to bring them forward and to empower them to have the same rights as you or I is so, so critical. But as you heard Rosa say earlier, the even more important piece is the implementation. And so we can have any law in the books, but what we need is everyone standing behind these workers, including the workers themselves, to know their rights and to come forward if they're not paid the minimum wage, if they're not granted overtime, if they're harassed on the job, things like that, to make sure that if there are abuses happening, they're brought forward and brought to the right authorities.
Now, Darcy, you mentioned, which I think might be surprising for people, that most human trafficking is for labor trafficking. Do we see human trafficking happening in the agricultural industry as well?
Absolutely. In our experience, as well as kind of national data through the national hotline and things like that, domestic workers and agriculture are actually the top two industries that we're seeing in terms of exploitation and trafficking taking place.
We're speaking with Darcy Jenkins. She's the Associate Director of Freedom from Trafficking with the Heartland Alliance based in Chicago. You know, one of the things that stood out to us as we were reading up on the new Illinois Domestic Worker Bill of Rights is that for years, we've been talking about two categories of people who've been excluded from these labor laws, domestic workers and agricultural workers. The fact that agriculturals are still excluded made us wonder why, and I wanted to bring someone else in to help answer that question as well. Miguel Caberline Gutierrez is a lawyer. He's the director of the Illinois Migrant Legal Assistance Project that's part of LAF Chicago, a nonprofit agency in Chicago. Miguel, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us as well.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Miguel, can you help us just explain a little bit of the history of why agricultural workers traditionally have been excluded from most labor laws when we're thinking about understanding different groups and how they fit into labor law protection in the U.S.?
Yeah, absolutely. I think someone earlier mentioned a little bit about it, but it certainly goes back to basically the end of slavery. At the time slavery was abolished in 1865, you still have the plantation model in place. It's not as if sort of slaves left the plantations. They were still there, and the workers that you had on the plantation were agricultural workers, and then you had people working in the homes who were the domestic workers. And we go into the period of Jim Crow laws all the way, you know, until the 1960s. But in the 1930s, when the Great Depression was going on, again, at that time, the country decided to push out over 500,000 Mexican-Americans. And then Roosevelt decided to push forth on the New Deal legislation, which was the Fair Labor Standards Act, the National Labor Relations Act, and the Social Security Act. And at that time, he needed Southern Democrats on board to get that stuff passed, and they specifically required that African Americans, basically in industries that affected the South, be excluded, which was agriculture and domestic workers.
So let's fast forward to today.
Sure.
Given that agricultural workers aren't offered the same protections as other kind of workers, can you give us an example of a few things that are legal for farm workers that would never be allowed in other occupations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, farm work is, when you talk about workplace injuries, it's one of the most dangerous professions we have. And it's the only profession that we allow children as young as 12 to work in legally. And, you know, it's been built on sort of this mythology of the small family farm and, you know, building character in young people and things like that, but that's not really the case. I mean, most agricultural work in the United States now is large factory farming, and it's something that's not addressed because most workers who work in agriculture now work sort of under the radar from public view. So you have children who can work in that. You also have no restrictions on how many hours of overtime people can be forced to work. They're not given any, there's nothing in the law that says they have to be given a day's rest. And in essence, they're lucky if they make minimum wage, but they're not entitled to overtime pay for the most part.
Right. And most people who come to Illinois to work on farms here, Miguel, where are they coming from?
So most that are recruited to come here are coming from the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. And then when they're coming on the H-2A foreign guest worker program, most workers are coming from Mexico and Central America. But you also get workers from Florida and the southern states as well who come up here.
Now, the H-2A visa, I wonder if you can explain a little bit about that, because immigrant workers who come to the U.S. on that, they do have they are eligible for higher pay. I know it's an average of about $12 an hour in Illinois, housing and transportation provided. But I know you've also said that you think the trade-off is fewer rights. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a program that basically an agriculture employer can go to the U.S. government, to the Department of Labor, and say, I can't find enough U.S. eligible workers to take on these positions. Let me bring in people from abroad. And there's an application for it, and they say how many workers they want. All they have to do is agree to pay the wage that is required, and then pay the transportation cost to and from, and provide housing. The problem with that is that it's a system that is also poorly enforced, and when workers are brought in, they're many times having to pay up front their transportation costs. So when they arrive here, they're already in debt. And employers take advantage of this in many different ways, but really they isolate the workers. The workers are brought in and sometimes don't even know geographically where they are. They might be in southern Illinois and believe that they're right next to Chicago. They have very little access to information here or to services, so they're really at the whim of the employer as to how they're treated. And so employers can say, we're paying them the wage, but you know, they're not putting on the books how many hours workers are actually working. They're, you know, holding things over the workers, like you won't get a job again if you complain. Or, and then the program also doesn't allow a worker to leave one employer and go to another if the conditions are bad. If they quit or leave an employer, they have to go back to their country. So a lot of workers stay in situations that are horrendous because they really have no other choice because they came here already in debt.
Miguel, do we have a sense of how many people are working in either H-2A visas in Illinois or other people who fall into this category in agricultural work?
Yeah, so in the H-2A program in Illinois, it's steadily been growing, but it's in the neighborhood of, I believe it's around 500 workers in the last 6 months. So it fluctuates up to maybe up a couple of thousand in a year. And then just traditional migrant and seasonal agricultural workers, there's approximately 75,000 that come to Illinois each year at the peak of the year, which is July, when people are here doing corn detasseling, amongst other things.
And Darcy, obviously, as Miguel's talking about this, it makes sense that these are the kind of conditions you've said would make people vulnerable to human trafficking. Do we have a sense of numbers of human trafficking in Illinois and how many people may be in industries like the agricultural industry who are there not of their own free will?
Yeah, numbers are pretty tough to come by when it comes to human trafficking because it is such a hidden crime. There are so many people being exploited and trafficked that we just haven't identified. I can say that our program to date in the past four and a half, five years have served over 100 survivors of trafficking and their family members. But again, that doesn't mean there's 100 survivors, right? There's so many more. We have just grazed the surface in terms of identification.
And when we're talking about whether it's trafficking or Miguel, as you've sort of outlined these other forms of exploitation, I wonder for you, what we've seen with this Worker Bill of Rights is, you know, we were hearing earlier in the hour about it providing a voice, helping empower people. Miguel, do you have any sense that there would be soon any change in Illinois law that would provide the same level of protection to agricultural workers that are now being extended to domestic workers?
I don't think so. To be honest with you, I think things have actually gone the other way in Illinois. Some of the basic things like requiring recruiters to have a license that the State Department of Labor would give them to say you can bring in workers, that law was basically repealed a few years ago. And so I don't see anything on the horizon as far as agricultural workers having conditions improved here in the state of Illinois.
Anecdotally, with the work, the legal work that you all do with the Immigrant Migrant Legal Assistance Project, do you see more people requesting assistance over the past year or two?
It's a difficult thing to sort of analyze that way, because when things are really bad, sometimes workers are more fearful about filing complaints because they know the challenges are going to be that there are even fewer jobs out there. And it's a very, very difficult topic to get to, because people are so highly isolated, and the way our legal system works makes it highly inefficient for people to bring real complaints forward. And so when you have people who are, you know, you have a family of four in agricultural work who typically makes $15,000 a year or less, you know, every cent counts to them. So litigating cases for them is just not a reality often, because it takes sometimes 4 or 5 years to get something litigated, and they can't wait that long.
Before we wrap up this conversation, Darcy, you know, as we've been talking about laws that exist, laws that people would like to exist, I wanted to ask you about an Illinois law that the Heartland Alliance has been involved with passing. It's called the Survivor Support and Trafficking Prevention Act. It was also signed into law last August by Governor Rauner. It actually takes effect a year from now. Can you quickly tell us what that's about?
Absolutely. So this act came about, as you said, it was signed in August of 2016, and it increases access to state-funded assistance, including health care, food, and income support, while victims of crime, serious crime, survivors of trafficking, and survivors of torture are awaiting their immigration status, so via the T visa, the U visa, or their asylum application. During this time, it's critical they can't legally work. They are arguably out of their trafficking situation or exploitation situation, but they are still in need of
what you and I need.
Right,
they don't
have
a way to support themselves. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, exactly. So this is giving them access to those programs while they wait for their immigration status and their work authorization.
You know, we just have about a minute left, Darcy, but I just wonder, as we're wrapping up this conversation, what do you want people to understand about the issue of human trafficking?
That's a great question. I think the biggest thing that we want people to understand is that the common misconception is that once a victim exits their trafficking situation, they're great, they're safe, everything's okay. But in reality, this is really the critical tipping point for trafficked individuals. Once they've escaped, they're still in that cycle of poverty, perhaps a cycle of violence. For many of the survivors we work with, they don't speak English. They might not have immigration status or access to their documentation, as we heard today. And they have no idea what services and resources are available to them. So unless a service provider, an attorney, law enforcement, or healthcare system identifies them, they're really just floating out there and isolated, and they're really at risk of re-exploitation and trafficking. And so the more people understand what trafficking is, the more hopefully individuals will come forward and seek assistance.
Mm. Thank you for joining us. That's Darcy Jenkins. She's an associate director with Freedom from Trafficking with the Heartland Alliance. I also want to thank Miguel Caberline Gutierrez. He is the director of the Illinois Migrant Legal Assistance Project with the Legal Assistance Foundation of Chicago. Darcy, Miguel, thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to be talking, we've been talking about new laws as the new year takes effect. Another one unfortunate part of January 3rd of 2017 is that we are now without a state budget in Illinois. We're going to be breaking down what that means. If you haven't been paying attention over the holidays, we're going to catch you up with two political reporters from around the state. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. By the way, if you follow us on Twitter, if you search for 21ST Show, we live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. So follow us there on Twitter, 21ST Show. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've got a new year and no budget. Illinois stopgap funding that was going to social service agencies, higher education, correctional institutions, and more is done. As the budget stalemate in Illinois continues into its 18th month, when will it end? Maybe you've been taking a break from this for over the holidays. To catch us up and help us understand what's going on right now, we're joined by two political reporters from across Illinois. On the line with us from Peoria is Chris Kergard with the Peoria Journal-Star. From Springfield, Jordan Abadea works for WICS News Channel 20. Chris Jordan, welcome back. Happy New Year, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so our stopgap budget has expired. What now? Jordan, where are we at?
We are at the same spot we were 6 months ago. Pretty much nothing has changed here in the state of Illinois. We had a brief stint with a stopgap budget, but otherwise everything's pretty much the same. The talking points are the same, the arguments are the same, and I think it's going to be more of the same going into this new year.
Chris, can you remind us what purpose the stopgap budget had been serving over the past 6 months?
The stopgap budget was intended to at least get some funds to social service groups, to state universities, and to others that had gone without in the previous year, those that weren't subject to other consent decrees or other agreements for payment. It was also intended to provide some breathing room for lawmakers on both sides of the aisle to be able to sit down and, once the election was passed, begin to work out a longer-term agreement for the remainder of the fiscal year that we're in through June 30, and there were some tentative meetings toward that at the end of November into the start of December, but there have been no talks for almost a month now. The last time the governor and legislative leaders sat down and had a meeting of any kind that we know of was in early December.
Jordan, I wonder if you can let us know what is going to happen to public universities, social service agencies. Let's start with public universities. What are we hearing from places like Chicago State, Illinois State University? What are they saying about where they're at with funding right now?
So basically, they're back to where they were before we had a stopgap budget. They're not going to be seeing that funding. Public universities are now deciding whether or not they can front money to students once again for MAP grants. They're deciding what programs can be cut, how they're going to keep the doors open. And, you know, this a year ago, this was different. This was the first time they were going through this. They might have had reserves and lines of credit. It's different this time around because they've already exhausted those lines of credit. They've already used up a lot of their reserves, and so now they're back to this point where they're trying to scrape together money. Some universities are better than others, but everyone is going to be struggling. There's going to have to be some tightening of the belt as they look forward to this new year. And so the same goes for all of those public service agencies that are, you know, working with the state, helping those social services stay together. The safety net for those people is falling apart in the state of Illinois, and it's been falling apart for the last year, and that's only going to continue. The effect might not be immediate because the state is so behind in payments, so it might be 6 more months before those people finally get their last payment from the stopgap budget. But, you know, the effects are ongoing, and every single day now you have the leaders of these social service agencies and public universities and all of these people who are struggling without their source of funding, wondering how they're going to keep providing services with less and less money coming from the state.
Well, and I want to highlight for both of you something Governor Rauner actually pointed out in an op-ed that he published in the State Journal Register, which, Jordan, as you noted, if you read this, it's almost exactly the same language that he's using, that he's been using for the past year. And I want to get to the language in a second, but I want to point out one thing he said, which is that last year, Illinois lost more residents than any other state, nearly 40,000 people. Governor Rauner quoted that in his State Journal Register op-ed. Chris, Jordan, I wonder where we're at right now is, you know, Jordan, as you sort of alluded to this, a little of the exhaustion, I'm not sure what word you fatigue, what you want to use. We're now going through our second round of not having a budget. Do you guys have a sense of what you're hearing from people? Chris, what are people saying in Peoria? How are they kind of coping with this?
There continues to be a deep frustration with it, but it's almost a pox on both their houses attitude that there's a recognition that there really has not been as much engagement from House Democrat leadership, from Speaker Madigan, as well as a frustration with some of the continued pushes by the governor and a deep concern, I think, that both sides remain entrenched in the talking points that they've been at from the get-go. We see service agencies here, like the local Center for Prevention of Abuse, that had to go out to its major fundraiser for the year and turn that, instead of expanding programs or being able to do more with programs, into a let's help keep the basics alive emphasis that they had this past summer on their efforts there. We have legislators here who would be have signaled that they're willing to compromise on some of these issues, not least on workers' compensation, which the governor has highlighted as a major initiative of his, but have yet to see a concrete plan that they can negotiate with. And that's another problem with continuing to stick to the talking points on both sides, is absent a concrete plan, there's not much that anybody can debate or come on board with.
Yeah, before we get to the talking points and the concrete plan, Jordan, let me ask you about Springfield. What are you hearing from local groups in Springfield? What are you hearing from lawmakers? What's the sense in the Capitol and in the State House about this stalemate?
Because Springfield is the capital city, the city itself feels this budget impasse, I think, perhaps more than maybe the suburbs and the city of Chicago and some of those places, because so much of state government is tied up here. And so if you talk to local businesses, they'll tell you that they're seeing people spend less money. They're seeing people who are worried about the future because there's an air of uncertainty that kind of hangs around the city. And so the mayor has even said, you know, they're seeing sales tax receipts lower than what they expected. They notice that there's some concern. We have very big hospitals here in Springfield who are the largest employers in the city who are still waiting on payments from the state, dipping into their reserves and running lines of credit just to wait for those payments from the state to keep open their doors and to make ends meet. And so if you talk to the people, just, you know, everyday people walking the street, the state of Illinois' problems are not new. Governor Rauner didn't usher in a new era of problems for the state of Illinois in terms of what people think. They just think that this budget impasse, as unprecedented as it is a continuation of the state of Illinois' corruptness, the lack of political leadership. They're upset with it. But for them, because Illinois has been in such bad shape for so long, this doesn't feel new. It's just a continuing dissatisfaction with the way politics run in this state. And so I think that is, you know, the budget impasse is impacting people's decisions to maybe think this is the last straw, we can move to a different state, or if they find a job somewhere else, you know, they're not sad to leave the state of Illinois.
We're talking Illinois politics with Jordan Abadea. She works for WICS News Channel 20 in Springfield, and Chris Kergar, who's with the Peoria Journal-Star. We're talking about the budget impasse. And guys, can you just remind us, because again, I just want to go back to, so Governor Rauner published an op-ed on New Year's Eve in the State Journal Register. And it's, I mean, it really sounds just like his budget address. It sounds like his State of the State address from last year. Illinois is going down the wrong path for far too many years. He goes over the things that he would like to see. Chris, can you just remind us again of those three major issues that Governor Rauner keeps saying that he wants? He talks about workers' comp, property taxes, term limits. Are those his? Those are his big three, right?
Those are his big three, and it's interesting that that he has put the term limits on the table as one that does draw fairly significant bipartisan support, at the same time that he continues to push for the property tax freeze, given what each of the individual legislators is going to be hearing from their hometown communities, from their school districts, from all of the various units of government around the state about that one. As I sit in on local meetings for county board, for other organizations of local government, that's the one that really has more people worried at the local level than anything, because they recognize the degree to which that will directly impact their budgets and their ability to provide services and perhaps change the discussion if a property tax freeze were to go anywhere from a state impact down to a local impact.
Jordan, have we heard anything from Democratic leadership? We saw this op-ed from Governor Rauner. Did we hear anything from House Speaker Madigan, from Senate President Cullerton over the holidays? Have we heard anything from them really since the beginning of December?
Speaker Madigan and President Cullerton aren't the type of politicians that are going to put an op-ed in a newspaper frequently. But what we're hearing from them is basically, we want to sit down, we want to negotiate a budget solution. They've been saying that for, you know, the 18 months that this has been going on. But what they're really saying is, at this point, the governor is saying to Democrats, you need to come to these negotiations with what your budget should look like. And the Democrats are saying, it's not our job to come up with the hundreds of lines in a budget. That's your job. Under our Constitution, we have an executive budget making process. You come up with the budget and we can negotiate on what you think. So it seems like they're passing the buck back and forth every time. You know, obviously, the state needs to make some cuts in order to make this budget work, along with some revenue and reforms like Governor Browner is asking, but nobody wants to be responsible for those cuts. You know, there is an election coming up in 2018. Nobody wants to wear those cuts. And so, you know, they're going back and forth on that. Democrats are still maintaining, though, the same points that they were maintaining before, that the budget shouldn't be tied to Governor Browner's turnaround agenda, that their agenda that the governor is pushing will not be good for working class people. It's important to note that that property tax freeze, whether or not you agree with it, the governor is saying that, you know, we can help local units of government pay for government if we give them some leeway on how they collectively bargain with their employees on some prevailing wage things. And so that weakens unions at the local level. And that's not something that Democrats, whether you're at the top, if you're Speaker Madigan or you're a Chicago Democrat or you're a Central Illinois Democrat, is going to vote for. Unions are Democrats', you know, biggest supporters. And so, you know, I think looking at some of these things, you when you really look at them deeper, it's not, you know, a proxy war between Madigan and Browner. It's not a thing about egos, but it does come down to policy in the end, and we're having classical politician discussions right now where nobody wants to blame for hard decisions that need to be made.
Chris, I wonder if you can help give us a better sense of the next steps. How long does it usually take for the legislator to get into a productive workflow at the start of the new session? Where are we at with dates for session now that we're back to the new year?
Well, and that's some of the added challenge to this. The outgoing General Assembly does have two more session days scheduled next week before the new legislature is sworn in. Some of us had looked last year at the calendar and had hoped, well, maybe there will be a bargain by then. Obviously, that does not seem to be the case, but the new General Assembly will be sworn in a week and a day, next Wednesday, but they tend not to do much. For the first month to 6 weeks that they're back in session, there are some ceremonial events with the governor's State of the State address coming later this month, followed by the governor's budget address coming in the middle of February, proposing, of course, his third budget without an actual budget being passed. And it's typically not until we begin to get into March that the legislature really, truly gets down to work, as you start to have the deadline for bills to get out of committee and then out of their chamber of origin as we get into March and then into April. And the rubber traditionally has not met the road for the legislature until early May most years, excepting the 1 year in the late 90s when they adjourned at the start of May. It's typical that lawmakers truly do not begin to address the difficult issues that they're facing in a given term until the last few weeks of May. So we could be in for another 4 to 5 months of very little action.
Jordan, one last question for you that doesn't have anything to do with local politicians in Illinois, which is, you know, Chris mentioned next Tuesday, President Obama is actually coming to Chicago. We saw some details about that. It's a farewell address he's planning.
Yeah, he's basically saying goodbye to his presidency, saying farewell. But it really sounded from the White House's message on this that he wanted to say thank you to all of the people who made him president, who voted for him and gave him this opportunity to sit in the world's, in some respects, highest office. And so he's going back to Chicago, which is his adopted hometown, and he's going to say thank you to all of these voters. And I think he's going to highlight some of the progress that's been made because, you know, his legacy now is hanging in the mix as this transition is made. So he wants to highlight some of the progress that's being made. And then he also wants to look to the future, and maybe he'll outline what a citizen Obama life will be like and what his role will be going forward. And you know, I'm sure he's going to talk to Democrats about what many see is a painful transition to a Trump presidency and give some hope to the Democratic Party of Illinois and the country.
Well, that's the latest in not just Illinois, but Washington politics. I want to thank Jordan Abadea. She's a political reporter with WICS News Channel 20. Thanks also to Chris Kjærgaard, a political reporter with the Peoria Journal Star. Chris, does this mean the budget beard is back on for you? Are you going to not shave until there's another budget?
I think I'm going to take a pass on that because who knows how long this one will last.
All right. Thanks for being with me, guys. That's unfortunately all the time we have for today here on the 21st. Tomorrow, as we mark this week beginning in 2017, we look back on the unfortunate 2016 full of horrific gun violence for Chicago and Illinois. We're going to take a look at what happened there, find out not just about Chicago, but the toll gun violence has on other communities in Illinois. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.